Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Today on Truth and Movies, Steve Coogan and Michael Winterbottom join forces for a high street satire. So we ask the question, is greed good?
We've been working on this party for over a year. He wants it to repair his reputation.
It's all about image. The superyacht, the models, it's all part of a brand.
Then Emily Beecham and Ben Whishaw star in Jessica Hausner's horticultural horror, Little Joe.
Little Joe changes the people he infects.
And in Film Club, it's back to the 80s for a mean green musical from outer space, Little Shop of Horrors.
What kind of a weirdo plot does that seem?
Little Shop of Horrors, a story about a boy.
I've given you sunlight, I've given you rain.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, sitting in the host chair, sitting across this week from Simran Hans.
Hello.
And Matt Thrift.
Hi.
Welcome both. How are you both feeling today?
Good today.
Pretty good.
No news from the White Lies Towers this week, so I think we should just dive straight into the new releases. Up first, we have Michael Winterbottom and Steve Coogan in Greed. Greed tells the story of a self-made British billionaire, Sir Richard MacCready, played by Steve Coogan, whose retail empire is in crisis. To save his reputation, he decides to bounce back with a highly publicised and extravagant party celebrating his 60th birthday on the Greek island of Mykonos.
He was his own man from the start.
What is the average wage in Sri Lanka?
50p a day. Imagine how many dresses I can get made.
He was a bully.
Nod your head and shake my hand.
It was a parasite.
It's classic tax avoidance.
Go away! Look at that. You can't buy a view like that. Oh, wait, no, I have.
We've been working on this party for over a year. He wants it to repair his reputation.
It's all about image. The superyacht, the models. It's all part of a brand.
A clip from Greed there. So, Simran, we said up top this was a high street satire. Is the target recognisable?
Oh, absolutely. I think anybody who knows anything about the British High Street will recognise the target of this film satire as Sir Philip Green of Topshop fame. Hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of the satire and the comedy is very funny in this film. However, I think Winterbottom is trying to do a lot of different things at once, and I think sometimes dropping some of the balls that he's trying to juggle in the process. There's sort of multiple plots happening. So we have the 60th birthday party being planned and all of the kinds of glamour and stress of all of that, and you know, they're trying to do celebrity bookings and get people for half price, and all of that's very funny. Then you have MacCready's daughter, Lily, trying to sort of be a reality star, and they're filming that on the beach. There's also some refugees who have set up camp because we're in Greece, so he's touching on that. There's a former employee of MacCready whose relative was involved in a fire in a garment factory in Bangladesh, which is sort of seems to be based on the 2013 real life events. There's a lot of things being juggled, and it's all kind of done in this mockumentary style format, told through the perspective of David Mitchell's character, Nick, who is a journalist turned biographer, kind of tracking the story, going back and forth between his childhood, him being in court. And there's all these moving parts that are quite difficult to juggle.
How many of those hit the target, do you think? Or is it too scattershot to say?
I think the only one that's really successful for me is the really light stuff, the party stuff. I think all of that's really funny. But some of the other stuff just doesn't quite work.
Matt?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with Simran. I mean, I think Gordon Gekko probably overstated it. I mean, Greta's kind of barely okay. I mean, there's just so much going on from its Howard's End allegory that it begins with, that, you know, this Philip Green impresario figure that's played by Steve Coogan is effectively, you know, Henry Wilcox from Ian Forster, this guy that's made his fortune by exploiting, you know, workers for slave labour in the colonies. And then that's all played along with this other allegory about, you know, Rome being built on slave labour as well, in the form of this toga party that he's throwing. I just think as kind of satire and as comedy, it's neither kind of sharp enough or really funny enough. I mean, it's perfectly amiable, and these, you know, these guys, these actors are, you know, a good bunch to spend, you know, a couple of hours with, but it just never really raises above the level of who it needs to be. It never really takes off, I don't think.
It's interesting that in the credits it says additional material by Sean Gray, from who wrote Veep and Succession, and he's sort of got a strange writing credit there, but I don't think the satire is as mean or as sharp or as funny as anything like Succession.
Right. Matt, you mentioned the cast, and the cast does go quite deep. Steve Coogan's bringing in a lot of his British comedy mates here. Any highlights, people you'd want to single out here doing good work?
I think Shelley Henderson is good value as Steve Coogan's mother. I mean, I think she's probably only a few years older than him in real life, mm-hmm. but she's playing a lot older. Isla Fisher, I think, is always great. She's, you know, a special shout out to her episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm this week, which is quite something as well.
Shirley Henderson has had quite the career. The last time we saw her on the big screen, apart from being Babby Frick in the latest Star Wars film, she played, it wasn't Steve Coogan's wife in Stan and Ollie, it was John C. Reilly's wife. But yeah, it's interesting to see that she's brought in by Steve Coogan, they're clearly old mates, to play these very strange roles. She clearly wanted to play his mum for a change.
She also does an amazing Derry accent. It's so specific. It's really funny. But they sort of aged her up, and she's all sort of hunched over and shriveled. Mm-hmm. She's very funny in this.
Some others that I think it doesn't quite work. I mean, Tim Key is usually pretty good with the sort of, you know, sardonic one-liner. I mean, he's really just kind of shouts his way through this one, which is a little disappointing. And Asa Butterfield, he's got this weird kind of Oedipal fixation thing going on, which I don't think really works for much.
Okay. And of course there's Big Steve himself, if we can call him that.
Wearing a wonderful set of veneers that are very distracting and large and polished.
Where do you think this ranks in his canon of characters?
I think, you know, he can play this role in his sleep, the sort of smarmy, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, self-made guy, but I don't think he's doing anything particularly new with that character. I don't think this one really stands out to me.
I mean, it's, you know, it's energetic, certainly. And I do, you know, there's stuff to be said, I think, for the flashback sequences in this that kind of chart his rise in the garment industry. But I mean, I think they've certainly done a lot of better work together. When you think back to, you know, something like a Cock and Bull Story, which is, you know, just really rich as far as it's satirical.
Did you feel like those flashback scenes worked better than the present day stuff?
I mean, I just think they had a kind of energy and a bit of vip to them in the way that they were edited. But I mean, I think as a whole, not much of it. Really,
yeah, for me, I just keep coming back to the problem, and you mentioned it earlier, Matt, with you know, how it's inspired by E.M. Forster, and there's the quote that says "only connect," and it comes at the beginning of the film and at the end. But I don't understand whether Michael Winterbottom has, you know, deigned to connect these things himself, or whether he's suggesting that the audience make the connections between all these different parts. And I just think the target is just too all over the place. Like, I think he's trying to take down the rich in a very basic way, you know, like, and it becomes literal in the idea of eating the rich later on in the film. I don't really want to spoiler it, but I do think that something happens that is very goofy, sort of towards the denouement of the film, that then seems undercut by this very serious ending where there's all these informational titles coming up as the credits roll, talking about the real life problems in the garment industry. And I understand that he is trying to bring people in and make this quite serious topic more accessible, but I just find it sort of slightly in bad taste. I also think the refugee stuff was very tonally weird for me.
I mean, it just tends to describe everything. I mean, there's a whole section, again, that it keeps flashing back to, which is clearly based on Philip Green's sessions in front of the parliamentary committee, in terms of for the pension funds that he ripped off. And again, I mean, it's just, it's describing all of these things and showing all of these things, but I'm not really sure it goes much further beyond that than anybody that has a passing, knowledge of who Philip Green is and what he's done and why he's bad. I just don't think this really digs any deeper and tells us much about who this person is, the society that's created somebody like this. And then, the way it kind of, again, with that, wanting to ruin anything, the kind of dramatic irony with which the film ends is, it's just a little weak, I think.
Do we have a sense of where Michael Winterbottom has made so many movies? He's quite quietly one of the British film industry's most prolific filmmakers. Do we have a sense of who he is as a filmmaker? Does this slot into a sort of thread through his career at all for you, Matt?
No, I don't think I could point and tell you what a Michael Winterbottom film is.
One with Steve Coogan in it.
One with Steve Coogan.
Okay. I think the sense of satire and of kind of digging into the structure of British society and kind of coming from a generally leftist perspective, I think you could say a lot of those themes cut across his work. But I think some of the sort of more interesting things he's made recently are the weirder, less Winterbottom-y things, like this very small film that he made a couple of years ago called The Wedding Guest, which stars Dev Patel. And it doesn't really 100% work, but it's this weird, wiry little thriller where and it kind of turns into sort of like a steamy love story, and it's sort of a bit silly but played totally straight. And it's just kind of unexpected for him. It's sort of almost like a travelogue as well. It's really beautiful and like all shot on location in India. And so I maybe want to see him doing more unexpected things like that. I think, if people want Steve Coogan and Michael Winterbottom, The Trip is there. All of those shows and the movie. Is there more than one movie?
Well, The Trip is coming back.
Yeah.
No matter what we
but
say,
that
it's
series,
back on
that series
soon, yeah.
is there for people to exist. And I guess you could say this is a kind of exaggeration of some of the things that are happening in those films. But I don't think they're as funny or as subtle.
Right. Well, let's put some scores on Greed. Simran, I'll come to you first. This is In Anticipation, Enjoyment in Retrospect.
I mean, anticipation, I guess, a 3. Sort of don't mind Winterbottom, not a huge fan, neither here nor there. Watching it, probably give it a 3 as well. Some laughs, goes down quite easily. Don't think it's sort of doing anything that radical, but also didn't hate the experience of watching it. But in retrospect, I think it's weak, and I think I have to give it a 2.
Matt?
Pretty much the same. I mean, I like this bunch. So, and they've done some great stuff together in the past, so probably a 3 in anticipation. And then 2s, I guess. I didn't really laugh as much as I hoped I would, and I didn't think there was a huge amount to think about, either while I was watching it or afterwards. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is Greed in cinemas this week. Up next, we have another new release, which is Little Joe. Against company policy, plant breeder Alice takes home a newly created species as a gift for her teenage son, Joe. They christen it Little Joe, but as it grows, so too does Alice's suspicion that her new creations may not be as harmless as their nickname suggests.
Haven't you noticed how Chris has changed? I think Little Joe's pollen has triggered something. Little Joe changes the people he infects. You're starting to notice too, aren't you? Fear can distort our perception of reality.
A clip from Little Joe there. So, Matt, I said up front that this was a horticultural horror. Maybe horror might be too strong a defining term for this film. How would you describe what this film actually is before we get into it?
I mean, it definitely has a kind of sense of the uncanny about it without kind of going into full-blown horror. Although there are kind of those elements, and there are a few moments that kind of play more into those genre tropes. I mean, Jessica Hausner, this is her, I think, her fifth feature. And her first in English, and she's an Austrian filmmaker that's throughout her career has played with questions of genre. Basically, her last film before this, 5 years ago, was a film called Amor Fou, which kind of slyly subverted the period costume drama. Her film before that, which is I think probably her best one, is a movie called Lourdes, which is about commercialization of the pilgrimage hotspot and miracles and questions of God and faith and so on. So on the surface, this is kind of a genre film as well. I was expecting a pretty straight take on the Frankenstein story, but this is kind of interested in other things, I think. You know, whereas all of these kind of Frankenstein geneticist films that we see tend to be more about the questions of playing God, this is more about kind of biological imperatives and really a study in motherhood and whether that biological connection is something that is always to be cherished, let's say. So this little plant is basically a metaphor. This creation that she's made, that she's genetically modified, that needs love and affection and so on in order for it to release this pheromone that makes people happy, ends up having the completely different effect, this depersonalizing effect. And yeah, it's really, I guess, at its heart, a film about the relationship between her and her son. But Jessica Hausner is a director that's always used artifice and movement and space and design. And this is a really, really designed movie, almost to a fault, perhaps. Quite a chilly movie as well, one that I think I struggled perhaps to connect with in the moment, but I'm starting to think, since seeing it yesterday, I was perhaps a little bit harsh on my first thoughts of it, and something I want to sit with for a little bit longer, I think.
So, man, how did you get on with this film? Chiming with what Matt's saying, or different?
Well, I think that when I'm watching a movie, I'm looking for it to do a bunch of different things, but the two kind of questions that I'm asking myself are, is this moving me emotionally, and is it moving me intellectually? Emotionally, no. I absolutely could not connect with this film, and I think defenders of it will say that that's kind of baked into the film's design, that it's very deliberately austere, that it is trying to kind of play with the idea of sterility, both in terms of the plant actually being sterile, and that's why there's all this drama happening with the botanists looking after it, and also with the sterility of Hausner's sort of cinematography and design. But also there are just things that are too sterile about it for me, like, for example, the dialogue and the kind of interaction between the characters. I think that, you know, she's an Austrian filmmaker. This is her first in the English language. I believe she co-wrote it with somebody who does speak English as their first language. And I wonder if it's sort of fair for me to suggest that perhaps there is a sort of slight language translation issue happening here. But for me, that kind of the flat affect of the delivery reminded me a lot of Yorgos Lanthimos, who's a Greek filmmaker, whose films I don't historically get on with. I like The Favourite, not a fan of his other English language movies. But I wonder if that awkwardness, that kind of cultivated awkwardness, is something that is just a taste thing, and maybe it just doesn't work for me. In terms of, you know, what Matt was saying about it kind of being something that you want to mull over and think about, I think there are some interesting ideas happening here, but I just find it slightly too cerebral for me. I don't find I can kind of lock into it comfortably, and I don't know whether that's her or whether that's me. I don't know if whether it's just me or you, Jessica.
It's interesting. It's pretty kind of diagrammatic in the one sense. It kind of lays everything out and spells everything out for you. I mean, there's Emily Beecham's character goes to see a shrink, Lindsay Duncan, played by Lindsay Duncan, who's effectively her role is to essentially spell out all of the subtext of the film in these therapy sessions. And I definitely agree with what Simran was saying in that when I was watching it, I didn't feel really any connection to it. But then when I thought about it being a film about lack of connection and depersonalization, and it is perhaps on purpose, perhaps not, creating this sort of distancing effect, whether that makes it good or not, and for a film to be cold and about emotional distance and depersonalization, to have that effect on me to the point where, you know, I'm not connecting with it perhaps as a viewer, whether that's... And that's the kind of...
Well, for me, the problem is that if it's about... If the whole metaphor, the central metaphor of the film is about the anxiety between a mother and a son, we have to invest in that relationship between the mother and the son to care. Otherwise, it is just an intellectual experiment. And I just don't really feel the chemistry between the two performers. I found their dialogue really clunky. And that didn't really work for me. I also thought that the film was saying something slightly interesting, slightly troubling about the pharmaceutical industry. Right. And maybe that's a more kind of surface level reading of it. But they're genetically engineering these plants to cure depression. And then the plants kind of take over the characters, and they become totally dependent on them and sort of shutting out all of their other relationships. And I guess you could read that as, you know, people who take medication for depression as a kind of a critique of their dependency on drugs. But I don't know if that is sort of a fair critique to make. I mean, I understand that, you know, where she's coming from, and this idea of numbness being something that you know, we reach for when we're uncomfortable, but I think that's a pretty strong statement to make.
So I wonder whether the answer is quite evident from the conversation so far, but Jessica Hausner is a new filmmaker looking on British society, or at least English language, as a new entrant into English language cinema. Are we excited about this based on this film?
I mean, I think she's doing what she did. But I mean, I think she's a brilliant director, a brilliant visual director. I mean, Amor Fu, I think perhaps most brilliantly, without the characters saying anything to each other, you know, tells you a lot about relationships and these people's places in the society and places in the context of the period drama as a genre as well, simply by the way that she positions them on the screen, the way she moves them in relation to one another. And she's doing similar stuff here, but I think also at the same time with this, she's lumbered with a narrative that needs a lot of explaining, that, you know, she needs to spell out a lot of what she's kind of doing here in terms of theme, where before, I think in her earlier films, she very much did that most of the work visually, which is why I think I got so excited about her. So I think it's a really exciting director with perhaps not the best match of material here.
I mean, it looks cool. The colours are amazing. Like, it's this sort of pastel colour palette that's being used, and Emily Beecham has this kind of very striking orange kind of short hair in this sort of circular helmet-like bob, and she's dressed in all these really kind of very coordinated outfits and boiler suits in pale pink and pale grey and pale blue. And
there's a sort of mint green or sort of pale green.
Yeah, they're lab coats.
But as a person of the ginger persuasion, I'd love to own one of those.
I think it would look really good, Michael.
Thank you so much. What scores would we put on Little Joe then? Matt, I'll come to you first.
I think definitely a 4 in anticipation. I've loved basically everything else that she's done. This is a really tough one. I mean, probably a 3 in the moment. And afterwards, I mean, I kind of want to sit with it a little bit more. And I mean, I only watched it yesterday, but I'll go with a 3 for now, just which denotes me being on the fence, I think, okay, a little bit.
For me, I was reasonably excited about it and looking forward to it. It had very positive reviews out of Cannes, where it premiered in competition. Beecham won Best Actress. Mm-hmm. I was looking forward to seeing it. And so I would say anticipation, probably a 4. On watching, didn't really work for me at all. Probably give it a 2 for enjoyment, and on reflection, I have to give it a 2 again. It really didn't click with me at all.
Well, that's Little Joe, rounding off our two new releases this week. Up next, we have Film Club. We're sticking with the plant theme for the 80s botanical blockbuster, Little Shop of Horrors.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Rick Moranis leads this big screen adaptation of the off-Broadway musical take on the Roger Corman B-movie. Moranis plays a nerdy florist who finds his chance for success and romance with the help of a giant man-eating plant who demands to be fed.
What kind of a weirdo plant is that, Seymour?
Little Shop of Horrors, a story about a boy.
I've given you sunlight, I've given you rain. Looks like you're not happy, unless I open a vein.
Such a weird
plan.
A girl.
You don't make nice boys when you live on Skid Row, Mr. Mushnick. No, this is my date, my boyfriend.
A florist.
I'm telling you, Audrey, he's not a good, clean kind of boy.
He's a professional.
The classic trailer for Little Shop of Horrors there. I must admit, I'd never seen this film before. I'd missed out on it growing up, and it was great to finally get around to watching it. So, Simran, have you seen this before?
No, I hadn't, and my sort of take on it was very similar to yours, because I knew of this film mainly through my dear stepdad, who often would quote at the dinner table when we all sat down, "Feed me, Seymour," and so I only know it from that. And he, you know, he was telling me when we were growing up, like me and my sister, that we should watch this movie, and of course we never did. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to now have context to my stepdad's jokes.
Did it stand up to whatever you thought in your head this film was?
Well, I should start by saying I don't really like musicals. I just don't really watch them. When I do, I just find them quite hard work. So I was prepared to endure this movie. And actually, it's really fun. Mm-hmm. I really had a good time with it.
So, Matt, do you have a history with the
yeah,
shop?
Yeah, I mean, so as a child of the 80s with a younger sister who was a, you know, Grease and Wizard of Oz and all of those fanatics, this was on loop in our house growing up for quite a while. You know, it's funny, I hadn't seen it for a long time since I was a kid, and I do like a musical. I like a kind of classic Hollywood musical, but I am, you know, kind of slightly allergic to the sort of more Broadway style musicals that Menken and Ashman are famous for. But, you know, watching this again, I mean, it's pretty irresistible, and I think that's largely down to those two central performances, and of course this kind of constellation of great supporting turns from the likes of Steve Martin and John Candy.
Who's weirdly hot in it?
Is it the dark hair?
It's the dark hair. It's not, I should add, the fact that he is a masochistic dentist. But he looks different when he was young. Would you believe it?
I mean, it's such a great little idea as well. I mean, so this is a remake of a 1960 Roger Corman film that was famous for being shot in just 2 days. And Jack Nicholson has a tiny cameo playing effectively the Bill Murray part in this masochist that wants to go to the dentist and have his teeth pulled out. So for this one, they gave him his opposite in Steve Martin's sadistic dentist, and the kind of clash between those two is one of the highlights of this, I think.
Can I say that the supporting cast and cameos they're on the poster, they're talked up quite a lot. That's not what really resounded for me watching it. That's not what delighted me, even though you do have Bill Murray and Jim Belushi. Mm-hmm. Christopher Guest turns up really early
on.
Yeah. Kind of slightly unrecognisable, I guess, because it's in that mid-80s period where you're used to seeing him more made up or in costume, maybe, in The Princess Bride, etc. But for me, Rick Moranis really carried this film. And he's somebody as an actor who you normally just see in supporting roles, yeah, or usually beholden to some bigger, higher concept, like in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, or he's maybe a utility player in Ghostbusters. But to see him carry a musical role like this was a real revelation to me.
I mean, absolutely. And one thing that's kind of really interesting is that I hadn't seen until revisiting this week was the VHS that we had when we were kids, that was probably taped off telly, was the theatrical released version of this film, which ends with a happy ending of them returning to this Rockwellian dream that they've got and getting married. But I'd never seen the director's cut ending, which was chopped off of it, after some test screenings. Yeah. And it ends with this kind of big Ghostbusters style rampage through the city that really makes the film and really makes satire bite a lot harder than and the romantic tragedy as well, which is again just not there in him feeding her.
Were you aware of all this, Simone, when watching it?
I did kind of have a read up of it afterwards and understood that there was an alternative ending, but I think there is a sort of subtle bite in the happily ever after when you get that closing shot of the smiling baby sapling of Audrey 2. So I guess it's less direct, but it is hinted at.
I also love the fact that this is such a great product of the British studio system of the 80s, where these American films would come over and be shot on British soil. That street set they create, actually on the 007 stage, isn't it, is so amazing. The production design is just off the charts. It's all physical as
Really,
so that ending when you watch it probably just makes it bust out a little bit of that staginess of it for me, maybe.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's more the sacrificing of the two main characters, which you don't get in the theatrical edition. Mm-hmm. So, him feeding her. And this is, I guess, if, on some level it is a satire of the American dream and the cost of success, and that you have to, give your blood to make it. And at what cost do you stop? When he literally feeds his girlfriend to the plant and then gets eaten himself, and then they just destroy, it's capitalism run rampant at the end. Yeah. It was much more like a sort of Joe Dante movie than...
Perhaps so. Do you have a favourite song?
It's got to be the classic, Feed Me.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere That's Green, maybe, I think.
I think it's Suddenly Seymour, where all the way through, Ellen Green has this very specific on-camera kind of energy, and she has such a squeaky, closed-throated voice, and then when she just opens up in Suddenly Seymour, it's like, wow!
There's a lovely clip on you can find on YouTube that was because Ellen Green originated the role off-Broadway before making the movie.
And they wanted to have Cyndi Lauper instead.
Yeah?
For the film.
I can see that.
Yeah.
But she came back and did it on Broadway for just two nights in 2015 with Jake Gyllenhaal. And there's a clip of them, you can watch about 20 minutes of the show on YouTube of them two doing Suddenly Seymour and so on.
How's Jake in it?
He's pretty good. I mean, it's more of it's one of those, what do you call them, where it's not a full production, but scripts in hands and sort of a dress thing. But yeah, really good.
So it's in the news in the past week that Rick Moranis, who very much semi-retired from filmmaking in the mid-90s to look after his family, he's coming back for a remake, reboot, sequel, whatever it is, of the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids franchise. And it's fascinating. Some of the conversations I saw coming out of that, he's only really a figure in the memories and minds of people who were kids at a certain time, maybe in the mid late 80s. Yeah. And I wonder, given the range of ages we have on this podcast, are we actually that excited about Rick Moranis coming back? So, Simran, do you have much of a relationship with this guy?
I don't know who that is. I didn't recognize him from other things in this movie, but I'm sure if you reeled off his IMDb, I would have seen them.
Well, he was in the two Ghostbusters movies, and you know, that is probably the films that are wheeled out and showed the most out of what he made. And the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids franchise was very much of its time, I guess. Didn't really endure. But he has this run of supporting roles that kind of set him as one of the great comic actors of that generation.
Spaceballs.
Well, another one that isn't wheeled out very much. That's Mel Brooks' Star Wars spoof. But yeah, are you excited to see him come back?
I mean, I guess so. I mean, I'm more interested to see what they're going to do with this. I mean, I think they're just calling it Shrunk or Shrink or something now. But I don't know who's making it. I don't know who's behind that. I was looking at, we were chatting a little bit before this about Rick Moranis, and I looked up Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which again, you know, was on TV like every weekend when I was a kid, but I haven't seen since, and kind of quite surprised to find that was, you know, A, directed by Joe Johnston, and B, written by, you know, Brian Usner and Stuart Gordon. Mm-hmm, so yeah. The guys behind Reanimator and Society and these Lovecraftian horror films.
So who did they get for the new one?
I have no idea.
Vintage.
Yeah.
And of course they're remaking Shop of Horrors, Little Shop of Horrors as well.
Yes.
They haven't confirmed the cast, but I think Billy Porter is tapped to play Audrey 2, and Scarlett Johansson and Taron Egerton are also in.
What do you think of that potential casting?
They could do better. They could do more interesting casting. I also heard Lady Gaga might be rumoured, which would be amazing, but I don't know.
That would be a choice, wouldn't it? I think Seymour has to be such a particular sort of nerdy guy. Taron Egerton, we now have a very different expectation of what he could be on screen.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Jonathan Groff played him on stage, and he's, I think, such a talented actor and also a very talented Broadway star. But I guess it's a good opportunity to sort of refresh the cast and have someone different.
Yeah, and that voice on Ellen Green, I mean, it's pretty hard just to find an actor that can sing as opposed to, you know, a real...
Zendaya?
Ooh, interesting. And I guess the big question about a remake would be, how would they do Audrey 2? Probably CGI. Whereas this is just the absolute pinnacle of what could be done with Jim Henson-inspired, Jim Henson-adjacent puppetry in the 80s, all manipulated by hand. They used... some trickery, didn't they? They ran the camera at different speeds and lip-synced to make that eerie, lifelike movement work. And it still stands up today, I think, that particularly
the
mouth movements.
Yeah, although Janet Maslin in the New York Times at the time in her review said that she thought that the syncing up was not working. She was critical of that at the time.
I wonder which, though, because Rick Moranis, I think, so because they were filming at half speed... Or maybe they were filming double, whatever, whichever way they were doing it. Rick Moranis had to sync with that, so he would be either lip syncing quickly or lip syncing slowly.
Do you think it's easier to lip sync quickly or slowly?
You're the person with acting experience here, Matt. Which would be harder for you?
I think this slowly would be more of a challenge. Yeah, for sure. I think.
Anyway, that is Little Shop of Horrors. A recommendation from the table?
Absolutely.
Even if you're not a fan of musicals, I think this is a pretty good one. I'm not particularly a fan either, and I had a great time watching this one for the first time. Next week, we have Portrait of a Lady on Fire, one of those big films from Cannes last year. We also have the new film from Todd Haynes, Dark Waters, and because of that, Film Club is Todd Haynes' 1995 film, Safe. Let us know what you think of those at the usual channels, which are truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, @truthandmovies on Twitter, or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. Simran, Matt, thank you so much for joining me this week and talking through those films. I'm Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.